Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Yeah, I like that. Yes, it is 12 o'clock. It's Monday, and this is
What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and I am your host, Katie Kiefer. And we are going to have a bang-up show today. It's called 20 Questions with Dr. Marion Nessel. But before that, there's this, and that is my weekly joys and sorrows. And I have some brilliant news for you people. The cans, you know how much I loved Sam Brownback, right? Or rather, how much I hate Sam Brownback. But anyway, or not even hate, I despise Sam Brownback. But anyway, so for months, like over a year probably, I have been, you know, constantly combing the news for... More news about Sam Brownback's failed experiment in economics, otherwise known as trickle-down or supply-side economics, something which he has imposed on the people of the good people of Kansas for the last 6 years, I guess. And, I don't think I need to remind you that the state has been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy now for the last 2 or 3 years. Anyway, the brilliant news is the following, that the Kansas legislature has finally come to its senses and pushed back against Brownback, and they are on track to raise taxes in order to revive their failing state. Thanks to Governor Brownback's moronic embrace of supply-side economics, a ludicrous theory in which cutting taxes on the wealthy is expected to drive economic growth, and I might add, it is a ludicrous theory that Paul Ryan is trying his best to impose on the rest of us now. The state of Kansas has been sailing near the edge of bankruptcy with major disruptions in fundamental services, not the least of which has been education. In fact, they were sued by their state Supreme Court because their funding had fallen below a certain threshold, which made it basically not in compliance with the law. Anyway, in the meantime, Governor Brownback... let me get to the punchline. The legislature actually brought a bill forward to increase taxes, and Brownback actually had the nerve to veto this. But happily, the legislature has overridden his veto, and they are about to raise taxes in a major way in Kansas, and not a moment too soon. And in the meantime, Governor Brownback, because of his revolting toadying to the Cheeto in chief, appears to be headed towards some sort of Trumpian award of a cushy job, otherwise known as being the ambassador to the UN for food and agriculture, which even in this age of ultimate irony seems like the most ironic thing I ever heard. Anyway, he's not yet confirmed, but that's only because Trump has more important things on his agenda than to make appointments, which, as you all know, he is singularly lacking in focus to do. I think there's like over 500 jobs, essential jobs of the government that have yet to be filled. But I digress. Anyway, and secondly, joy indeed. It turns out that the Donald Jr. is as much of a braying blabbermouth as his daddy is. He confirmed Comey's version of the secret conversation about letting Flynn off the hook in a recent newscast, I think it was yesterday, where he said, yes, when my dad says something, he means it. And when he told Comey to back off of Flynn, he wasn't kidding. What a maroon! Love it. I just love that. Okay. So anyway, as I discovered while I was writing the chapter in my book, What's the Matter with Meat, on Asia. I learned that the Chinese have polluted about 60% of their soil with industrial chemicals, including one called cadmium, a heavy metal, which will cause renal failure, among other things, and various cancers and so forth. Anyway, and they have been, pumping cadmium into the water supply, I don't know, into their rice paddies, and then from thence into their population, which has had quite an impact, as you might imagine. And it really made me wonder just how much we test our soils for pesticide and herbicide residue and heavy metals. I remember a few years ago, there was like quite a panic about arsenic being in rice because we were spraying chicken manure over rice fields. And the chicken manure was full of non-organic arsenic, which is what happens to the arsenic drug that they were feeding the chickens, which has now been banned. But still, anyway, it was there and it's probably still there. But we don't talk about it anymore. Anyway, if you do have information about soil residues, I'd love to hear about it. How much that is being tested. I mean, given that the USDA is facing these whopping budget cuts and that in general, I feel like things like that don't get tested very much anyway. I'd love to know from people who do know what exactly is going on. So you can write on my show page here on Heritage Radio Network, or you can write on my Facebook page for What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. Or I think it says with Katie Kiefer, actually, and or even better, head to my brand new website, katiekiefer.com, www.katiekiefer.com. And that has some information about my book and links to other things that I've written and shows on this network and so forth. Anyway, it will further direct you on how to contact me. I really don't understand what to do with my Facebook, with my website, but I made it anyway. Just goes to show you, like, I really still dwell in another century, I'm sorry to say. And finally, and this was quite interesting, I read this in the Environmental Health News today, Monsanto is finally being busted for suppressing information on the cancer-causing properties of Roundup, the world's most widely used agricultural chemical. This was reported on by one Carrie Gillum, who writes for various publications, longtime reporter for Reuters, but now is involved with some other places. Anyway, she published this in Environmental Health News. It was a very interesting article. Apparently, Monsanto managed, big surprise, suppress some seminal studies about the growing of tumors in mice that were fed Roundup, saying that they were not, adequately controlled or, some other kind of science gobbledygook. But anyway, this should be a really quite an epic situation. I think Monsanto is being sued. So that's it for Joys and Sorrows. We're going to take a quick sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Dr. Marion Nestle to play 20 questions on, everything that she knows. Stay tuned.
Bob's Red Mill is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and a big supporter of organic farmers. Ray and Tom Williams are two farmers who have worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray shares what their relationship with Bob's Red Mill means to them.
We thought that for over the long term, we thought it would make sense, better sense for the soil. Also, we thought that it was something that would improve the quality of the food supply. We're lucky in that we're working with Bob's Red Mill. We're part of a regional food network. With Bob is a fundamental relationship and cornerstone to that. We also work with other best-of-class people in the Northwest, and we're thankful for the long-term relationship that's brought good things to the soil and good things to our long-term farm economic plans. We appreciate his attitude toward absolutely high standard for the benefit of his customers. We take pride in meeting those standards.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. And today, we're going to play 20 questions with one of my very favorite guests, Dr. Marion Nessel. And as if she needs an introduction, well, I'll give her one anyway. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, which she chaired from 1988 to 2003. She is also the Professor of Sociology at NYU and a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. Her many books include the seminal Food Politics, What to Eat, Soda Politics, Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, and Why Calories Count, and many others. And she hosts the website Food Politics, where she blogs for most days. Welcome, Marion.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. So, oh my God, 10 years of blogging. I think you are to be congratulated. That's quite a milestone. That's a milestone.
It's a milestone. I couldn't believe it. I was looking back, and the WordPress has this terrific search engine, so you can go all the way back to the beginning and look at every post you ever wrote, should you want to do that. And I thought, holy smoke, I have an anniversary coming up.
Well, I think it's really impressive, and you make it look so easy, and especially given the workload that you commonly labor under, it's really even more impressive, I got to say. So what are you working on right now? I know you have another book in the works.
On the blog or on
in your, in the rest of your life.
In the rest of my life.
One of your many
books about
another
food
book.
Industry funding of nutrition research.
Oh, excellent.
That is keeping me very busy.
Excellent. If people have not been keeping up with food politics, which really shame on you if you haven't, you should know that Marion does a roundup on a regular basis of who is paying for what food studies. Constantly blowing up various entities in the food industry, I'm sure much to their chagrin.
I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, really, I
can't. It's the least I can do.
I think so, absolutely. So the way I formulated our show today was I thought of basically 20 questions for you. So I wanted to start because one of your last posts on food politics was about the Farm Bill and a couple of graphics that Debbie Stabenow had put up. And they describe some of the budget cuts to food stamps, conservation, export, et cetera. And I thought maybe you could go through some of those programs.
Well, you can just do it as a generality. Just assume that there's at least a 30% cut to anything that you care about.
Jesus.
Is what's been proposed, a 30 to a 50% cut. But we have no idea how that's going to end up.
Yeah.
It really depends on what Congress does and what the lobbyists do and what happens between now and the time that they get around to dealing with this thing. So I hate to go into it in really great detail until it begins to look as if it's something that's real.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But I mean, there were some things that just blew my mind. Like, for instance, the broadband programs. I mean, there are so many places that still need access to the internet. And the idea that funding, for example, could be on the chopping block was really kind of shocking to me, because I think a lot of farmers really depend on that.
Well, it was particularly shocking because it was the great accomplishment of the Obama administration when USDA Secretary Vilsack came into the administration. One of the things he promised was to revitalize rural America. And the one way in which they were able to actually contribute to rural America was by putting in broadband and getting broadband into those areas of the countries that don't have it. And so for Trump to take it out when those are his supporters seems kind of amazing.
It is to me
when it's so, it seems like such a simple thing to get cell phone access and internet access into places that don't have it. I go to Ithaca a lot, and there's a 30-mile stretch on the route between New York City and Ithaca that doesn't have any broadband service.
Wow.
It's kind of amazing.
It is, and that's New York State.
Northern part of Vermont, no cell phone access.
Yeah. I mean, and that's New York State. I noticed that when I was up in Shelburne Farms last year, actually, the same thing. There was absolutely no broadband anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, and for those of us who are dependent on it, it's distressing.
Yes. And, you know, for people who were really dependent on it in ways that I think you and I don't really appreciate, just because most of the time we do have it, obviously it's a much bigger deal. I mean, I'm thinking about, like, if you have a fire sweeping towards your property and you want to alert your neighbor next door and you don't have a cell phone to do it
around
the field, you know, like that kind of stuff, or summon the fire department. I mean, that sort of thing. You know, what's so amazing, though, Marion, is like it seems like Trump really has no idea who his supporters actually are, because so many of the programs that are being targeted for disruption are basically the programs that most serve that constituency. And that's the disconnect that I just don't understand. Like, who did he think was voting for him?
Well, I don't think he thought about that at all, but the assumption is that the people who voted for him will vote for him no matter what. And the polls that I've seen and the interviews that I've seen, they think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, I've seen that too. It's really distressing. But I think even Republicans are going to shy away from a lot of. I mean, I can't imagine somebody like Chuck Grassley, or, you know, I mean, he's a farm state guy. You know, like any of these guys who are in the farm states, they're not going to roll over for this particular.
Well, they're being very quiet.
Yeah. Well, I think they're hoping that he won't notice when they do pass something slightly less draconian, because after all, he doesn't really pay attention to anything. So
hard to know.
It's hard to know. Now, what about something like the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, which, you know, all of these sort of signature Obama initiatives are being axed right and left. Do you think that Congress will end up to overturning that particular act?
Well, I think it will do what's been asked for, which is to relieve some of the nutritional restrictions and that the School Nutrition Association complained about so bitterly over the last several years. I think they're going to get what they want. And, you know, all I can do is roll my eyes and agree with Michelle Obama. Doesn't everybody want kids to eat healthfully? Why would you not want your kid not to eat healthfully?
I know, it's inexplicable.
And wouldn't you like some help with that? I mean, it just makes no sense to me at all. But when it's framed as draconian government nanny statism, then people really resent it. They don't want the government telling them what their kids should eat, even though the government has been telling their kids what they should eat for years and years and years, based on the junk food that was allowed in schools.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, one of the things that Republicans love to point to is that the kids don't eat their vegetables and fruits in school, that stuff ends up in the waste bin.
Well, it depends on what school you go to.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, that's certainly true in some schools. I've been to schools where that is absolutely the case.
Yeah.
I have also been to schools that have some adults in them. And if those adults happen to care about whether the kids are eating the food or not, they make the food taste good. They work with the kids around it. The kids eat the food, and there isn't a lot of plate waste. I've been in both.
Yes, exactly. And so that would suggest that we need a lot more in the way of people in the school who help the kids understand. Because just as Michelle Obama said recently, she said, well, they don't like learning math either. You know, like,
exactly.
So what
exactly. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me because I can walk into a school and tell in seconds whether the kids are going to be eating the food or not by the behavior of the people who are running the school meal program. And these are very school-dependent. Every school is different. And so even though the rules are the same, the way those rules are implemented is very personal. And in a school where you have a principal, parents, teachers, and school food service personnel who think that feeding kids healthy food is a really cool thing to do, somehow it gets done.
Right.
And if you go into a school in which the culture of the school is we don't want the government interfering with what we do, and we're put upon, and this is horrible work, and we just are, you know, making up time doing this, but it's really no fun at all, the kids pick that up in a second.
Yes, I'm sure they do. Absolutely. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, I, like you, and like Michelle Obama, I mean, the idea that children do not deserve the very best in nutrition in a school program. It reminds me, did you see the Michael Moore film, Where to Invade Next?
I haven't yet, no.
Well, it's not his greatest film, I have to say, but one of the things that he talks about several different things. He goes to Italy and talks about vacation. He goes to Sweden and talks about the prisons. And he goes to France, of course, and he talks about school lunch. And he goes up to, I think, Normandy, or, you know, not an especially affluent or unusual part of France, and he shows what the basic meal is for the kids at lunch. And it's, you know, it's breathtaking. It's like so great. You know, it's clean, wholesome, not very fancy, but very nice food.
And the kids are eating.
And they, of course they eat it, because they eat that at home too. I mean, it's really no different from, you know, what they eat at home. And it's, you know, there is no issue about whether or not they're going to eat their little wedge of cheese or have their apple or their peach or their pear. I mean, it's just what it, and just to further dominate this conversation for a second, I wanted to tell you that when I was in France last summer, I stopped at a rest stop, and this really blew my mind. So every rest stop in the United States, as you know very well, is Subway, McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, Auntie Jane's, or, you know, Auntie Anne's pretzels, whatever. At the rest stop we stopped in France, they had a sort of fast food area that had freshly made sandwiches, salads, and quiche. And then they had like a cafeteria style sit down part of the rest stop where you could get things like smoked trout pate. I am not kidding you. And ratatouille. I mean, I thought to myself,
right.
What, we could do this.
Yeah, all you can do is laugh.
I know, exactly. But why? I mean, here's a question I hadn't anticipated asking you, but this is a good one for you. Why is it that, or how did it happen that these fast food franchises managed to invade the highway system to the extent that they did? What is the history behind that? How did that happen?
Well, I don't really know the history. I can only surmise that there was lobbying and there was pressure, and that they convinced whoever was running the transportation system in particular states that this is what people wanted and what they ate, and they might be right about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of astounded at how difficult it is to get something to eat at one of those places, but I'm not everybody's core customer.
Well, no.
I'm really not. And the, so, I mean, most people seem perfectly happy with it. That's what they want. It's what they're happy with. And when there's other kinds of things, I guess it doesn't sell. I don't really know.
Yeah, I think so. Because I noticed, for instance, there was a cheese boy on the way. I go up and back and forth to Rhode Island all the time. And there was something called a cheese boy, which was a little fast food chain, I guess, that sold grilled cheese sandwiches, which I rejoiced in, I have to say. Because I love
a
good
too.
Grilled cheese. They're gone. They shut down. They mm-hmm. could not compete with Moe's and McDonald's and, you know, Jimmy Cheese or whatever. I don't know. Anyway. But let us go on, because we have many more questions.
I'm not keeping score.
Okay.
I don't know where we are on your list of 20.
Okay, well, here's a real tough one. Let's talk about why America does not have a food policy and what it would mean if we did.
Well, we don't have one because nobody wants one. I mean, some of that is history, where because of the way the agencies are set up and they're in, the food is governed by the Department of Agriculture, the Health and Human Services through FDA, and the agencies are separate. They have long histories that go way back. They started out in the same agency. It all started out in USDA in 1906, but over the years, it split. And so they have different missions, different cultures, and different ways of approaching these problems. So it's the legislation isn't the same for the two agencies, so it's kind of hard to bring them together, even around something as straightforward as food safety.
Right.
So the original plan of the Obama administration was to fix the food safety regulations in FDA, and then bring USDA's food safety rules in line with FDA's and then put them together into a single food safety agency, but that didn't happen and it's not going to happen.
Right. So are you referring also to the Food Safety Modernization Act? Is that what that was?
Yeah, that was the Food Safety Modernization Act was to fix FDA.
Right.
And it did that very well, except it didn't give it enough resources to really carry it out. But at least it gave FDA the ability to recall products that were demonstrably harmful, which it did not have before. And it also puts an enormous burden of responsibility on the producers of foods to produce them safely.
Right.
Which seems like a really good idea.
Well, yeah. I know, it's amazing. Like, what a genius move. Incredible. Yeah. Well, I mean, sort of to build on that for a second, although I'd love to go back to the what we would look like if we had a food policy, but I also want to, you and I have talked about GRAS, the designation that is generally regarded as safe, G-R-A-S.
Recognized.
Generally recognized.
Is the correct word. Generally recognized as safe, or GRAS.
GRAS, right.
GRAS.
And there's a new lawsuit that is being brought against the FDA. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it could conceivably be a major step forward in, you know, using unregulated additives in the food supply?
Yeah, I mean, this is about food additives. So there are a lot of food additives in the food supply. And when this legislation started decades ago, it was clear that the FDA couldn't do investigations of the safety of every single one of these things because there's tens of thousands of them. And so they kind of did an estimation of which ones had been around for a long time and didn't seem to be killing anybody. And they called those generally recognized as safe and included in that sugar and salt, for example,
right,
are both considered GRAS ingredients. But there were food additives, the colors, flavors, texturizers, other kinds of things that were not. And for those, the manufacturer would have to demonstrate safety. So the way that the manufacturers do that is that they appoint a committee to review the evidence on the safety of a particular additive, and then that committee writes a letter, and the agency and the manufacturer voluntarily submits that letter to the FDA, and somebody at the FDA takes a look at it, and if it's okay, then it's okay, and it's GRAS, and if it's not okay, then usually what happens is the company takes the petition away. But the FDA is really not responsible for close oversight of these kinds of things, and the lawsuit is asking the FDA to do this. Again, something that seems so logical,
yeah,
but the FDA doesn't have resources.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I mean, earlier in the show when I was doing my Joys and Sorrows segment before we called you, I was asking listeners to tell me if they knew about how much or how little testing of soil we do on a regular basis, because I was referring to the Chinese discovering that there's an enormous arount of cadmium in their arable land, and that it has been poisoning their population for quite a while. And I realized I don't know how much testing we do. I remember there was a case a few years ago where they discovered arsenic in the rice because they had been spraying chicken manure, which had been treated with arsenicals.
See, this is where the complicated regulatory system gets bad, because the Environmental Protection Agency would ostensibly be in charge of soil quality,
right,
but the FDA is in charge of the safety of foods. So when whatever's in soil gets into food, then it's FDA's responsibility. And if animals are involved, it's USDA's responsibility. And you can easily think of examples where all three agencies need to be involved in a hurry, because if animals are eating plants that have a lot of cadmium in them, and we're eating those animals, that's not so great.
Exactly. So that's something where I don't, you know, you've just made the case. Like, clearly this testing and evaluations are not being done on a regular basis. And so we don't really know what chemicals are in our soils.
Everybody says if you're going to do backyard gardening in the city, you should have your soil tested.
Yes, absolutely, or do container gardening. But let's go back to the idea of what it would mean if we did have a food policy. For example, the issue that we just spoke about, that would come under a food policy umbrella, wouldn't it?
I would think so, absolutely. And we would have agriculture and public health linked. What a concept. because the FDA is in the Department of Health and Human Services. And, you know, there's a really weird business about that, too. Because, you know, I've already mentioned that FDA doesn't have enough funding or resources to do what it's supposed to do. And one of the reasons for that is that even though FDA is an agency in the Public Health Service, which makes it a public health agency, it gets its funding from agriculture, from the agriculture committees. Uh-huh. So the agriculture committees are the ones that are distributing the funding to the FDA, which doesn't really have anything to do with agriculture, except once the foods are done, then the FDA is responsible for their safety. Right. But this is a historical anomaly dating back to 1906.
That's amazing.
It would be nice to modernize this just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Well, I remember reading recently, I get that newsletter, IPES, International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food. I don't know if you're familiar with that publication. But they were, you know, I was reading through one of their back issues. This was a few months ago. And I noticed that there were a whole list of conferences going on literally around the world, you know, in Mexico, in India, in the EU, and all of those conferences were bringing together the elements that you and I are talking about right now. Agriculture, food, you know, sort of the equivalent of the FDA, and farmers and ranchers to talk about just this. Like, how do we, for example, improve the quality of our soil or diversify our crops or reduce salt, sugar, and fat from our food supply?
Or prevent climate change.
Yeah, that too. But these were all sort of like, these were government agencies that were all coming together to talk to each other to try to harmonize, you know, how they work together. And there was not, of course, you know, not a single mention of a United States entity in any of these. We just don't do that.
Well, we do on an informal basis. I was told that by people in FDA and USDA that they were talking to each other all the time during the Obama administration, at least on an informal basis. And there was one interagency effort, actually started by Congress and ended by Congress, to try to set nutrition standards for food advertising to children. And there were four agencies involved in that, and eventually Congress just put a stop to it.
Unbelievable.
Because the industry complains so much about the idea that there would be nutrition standards for marketing to children. Marketing to children is the food industry's line in the sand. They will not tolerate any incursions on that one or restrictions on that one because it'll put them out of business.
Jeez, that's a scary thought.
Mm.
I didn't realize that. I mean,
well, they have voluntarily said that they will not, or the soda companies have voluntarily said that they will not market to children under the age of 12 on television programs aimed at children under the age of 12.
Right.
But in 2 seconds, you can think of loopholes big enough to drive trucks through in that one.
Yeah.
You know, they advertise to children in lots and lots of other ways.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
and, you know, I've heard food industry executives say they just have to.
They just have to do it.
They just have to do it.
Yeah. Because,
otherwise, they don't make any money.
Oh, my God, Marion.
Well, food companies are not public health agencies,
right.
And it's unreasonable to think that they are. And it certainly makes no sense to think that they are. And if you look at them as public health agencies, you're not going to understand what's going on or you're going to be shocked. But they're not. They're businesses.
Yes, of course.
And the purpose of a business is to produce
income
for stockholders
and
very, very high salaries for CEOs. And high level executives. And Wall Street requires food companies, like any other company, to grow profits, and they don't really care how.
Yes. And that's the thing that always amazes me. I feel like there is some kind of fundamental disconnect between what I expect are basically pretty decent people, and yet when it comes, there is just a total blind spot about the implications of what they're doing when it comes to marketing, you know, breakfast cereals, for example, which, as you've pointed out many times, are essentially, you know, a cookie in flake form.
Yeah, I've known a lot of people who work for food companies. They're very nice people.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I mean, their rationale is that nobody is holding a gun up to people's heads, forcing them to buy this particular product. This is something that's completely up to individuals. It's a matter of personal responsibility. We don't have any responsibility for this. We're just putting it out there.
Right.
It's your fault if you're making bad choices. And, of course, this doesn't talk about the amount of money that's spent on marketing or the extraordinary fact that I still can't get my head around that marketing expenses for food companies and every other company are business expenses and they're deductible from taxes.
Ooh. My goodness. So, yeah, well, that does make it very appealing to spend a lot of money on marketing then, doesn't it?
If a company is marketing a junk food to your child, you're paying for that.
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's amazing, though. It's like the idea that you wouldn't, you know, with all the pushback that these companies are getting in the last few years in terms of, you know, the unhealthy qualities of, you know, Kellogg's is always saying, oh, we're reducing the sugar. You know, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're tweaking our formulas, that they can't really somehow fundamentally reverse engineer these products into something that actually would be more nutritious. I don't understand why they won't go that route.
Well, they can't, because you're talking about food products, but I'm a nutritionist. I'm talking about food. Mm-hmm. And there's a big difference between food and food products, what Michael Pollan charmingly referred to as food-like objects at one point. You know, the big problem is that when you, most of the money in the food system is in processing. Yeah. It's in the labor and the transportation and the advertising and all of the stuff that goes into a potato when it is turned into a potato chip, uh-huh. which is kind of an easy example for everybody to understand. So potatoes are really cheap,
yeah.
and the farmer doesn't get paid very much for them. All of the money in the food system is in potato chips. And once you understand that, then everything else that happens makes sense.
Yes.
So if you're in the food business, you want to make potato chips. You don't want to be selling potatoes.
Right.
Because there's no money in them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you want to be selling not only potato chips, but you want to be selling potato chips that have, you know, that are fried in olive oil and have special rosemary flavoring. And the more you can do to jazz up the potato chip, the more money you can charge for it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the more profitable it will be, because it starts out with very cheap ingredients, potatoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the entire food system is set up to keep the cost of basic ingredients as low as possible, which is really bad for farmers.
Yeah.
And all the money is in the processing.
Yeah, and it sustains a vast cohort of employment. I mean,
it does indeed.
Yeah.
So that everybody who's involved in food processing, transportation, marketing, yeah. sales, food service, I mean, all of those kinds of things. I mean, this brings us this incredibly varied food supply that, you know, where we can get anything we want anytime we want it mm-hmm. if we have enough money to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the cost of that in what happens to the environment and what happens to health is kind of amazing.
It is kind of amazing. And then also the fact that, you know, that the labor force is so, you know, so radically underpaid and underserved in terms of basic protections, basic labor protections is another aspect.
Yeah, they were excluded from labor laws through extraordinary amounts of lobbying.
Yeah.
So farm workers and restaurant workers.
Right. right.
You know, don't have to get paid the minimum wage. I mean, they do in some states, but not all. And, I mean, that's the basis of that. It's so unfair. That unfair system is the basis of the Fight for 15 campaign, which has been very successful in a lot of places.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I was talking about this just the other night at a local library because I was promoting my book, of course. And so I don't read. I just give a talk about the food system or lack thereof. And I managed to get myself together to look up some statistics. So it's 18 million jobs are accounted for in the food sector from farm to fork. And that's, I think they said something like 10% of our total job, you know, total employment.
Oh, I'm surprised it's that low. I thought it was higher.
Well, 18 million is a lot, I think.
Yeah. Not as much as I thought it was. I would think it would be more.
Maybe I'm wrong, Marion, and you're right.
Everybody eats.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But let's go with the 18 million figure. That's a lot.
But what I was saying to people who were saying, but it's so great to have cheap food. And I said, but you're paying for it through, you know, other means. You're paying for it in environmental degradation. You're paying for it in SNAP benefits, food stamps and Medicaid. You know,
and you're paying for it in bad health.
And you're paying for it in bad health. I mean, all the cost of those people who are sick from poor food is something that you're paying for as a tax, as a taxpayer. And that was a connection that people don't make. And I think that's
And the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, no kidding. And the fact that people can't drink the water in Toledo, Ohio.
Because in lots of places.
Right? Yeah. In fact, I was reading something in Ag Journal or Ag Farm, you know, one of the many journals that you and I peruse on a regular basis. And they were talking about how many farming communities have just kind of like, they don't even complain about the fact that they can't drink the water out of their taps. They just, that's part of the cost of doing business. They just accept that all of those, you know, phosphates and nitrates and, or whatever they are, nitrogen and phosphorus and, you know, all of that stuff that's in the water from fertilizer and pesticides is just a part of farming life.
And the smell of pig farms.
Yeah. And the smell of those chemicals in their water. Oh, my God,
right.
It stinks. It's horrible.
Right.
I mean, Des Moines, Iowa is a beautiful example of that. But I want to get to something that's become very trendy now. We're going to move on from that. We're going to talk about probiotics.
Oh, those are trendy.
So, aren't they so trendy?
Yeah.
It's amazing. So there have been a lot of new studies, some of which you listed on your blog, Food Politics, about how probiotics affect health. And I wondered if you could sort of separate a little bit of the wheat from the chaff about probiotics. I was particularly interested in the loss of something they call B. infantis, which is a probiotic that is passed from breast milk into babies, and the fact that women who have taken antibiotics often are deficient in that particular enzyme or whatever it is. What is it, Mary?
Well, it's a bacterium.
It's a bacterium.
Yeah, I mean, probiotics are bacteria, and a much nicer term for it, so that you know, you think, ew, I'm eating bacteria, ick.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you're eating probiotics, it takes away the ick factor.
Yes.
And then you also have to know the term prebiotics, which is foods that the human digestive tract can't handle, but they're food for your probiotics.
Oh, really?
Got that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Cool.
So
what are they?
This gets us into the microbiome, which is, you know, one of the most exciting discoveries of the last 10 or 15 years, where DNA analysis has gotten good enough so that scientists can go in and look at the different kinds of species of bacteria in feces and do kinds of analyses. And there have been some really particularly interesting ones going on with breastfeeding versus formula feeding. There are differences in the kinds of bacteria that are in the intestine. But you have to start with the idea, and this is you know, sort of icky to talk about, but you have to start with the idea that what you excrete is basically bacteria and the cells of your intestinal tract. It's not what's left over from food.
Really?
There's very, very little. There's very little of anything that's left over from the food we eat, maybe some fiber, but there are bacteria in the intestine who can digest that fiber, and that's why you get gas, and that's why you know, you sometimes have intestinal upsets. And there are uncountable numbers of bacteria in the intestine, trillions, not billions. You know, they're solid pack and they're microscopic. You can't see them individually. So it's kind of an incomprehensible system. And to try to tease out, and there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of species of bacteria.
Yeah.
And depending on what you eat and what your genetics are and various other kinds of things, you're going to be feeding some kinds of bacteria more than others, so they will develop faster and proliferate more. And for the most part, we haven't got a clue what any of it means. We don't know enough yet.
I think it's a fascinating thing. But do you think they're the magic bullet that's being suggested that it is?
Well, there's some magic
bullets.
Health? I mean, for people who have irritable bowel disease, they've tried fecal transplants, and they've had miraculous effects in a few people who've been lucky enough to have those work. But for the most part, we don't have any idea what's going on down there. It's really complicated, and lots of people are studying it because it's really interesting.
It is really interesting. I'm fascinated.
But, you know, the advice is always to eat a healthy diet.
Thank you, Marion. One thing I did want to ask you about was, you know how they have like a whole bunch of different types of probiotics? Okay, so what do you think are the best ones? This is a consumer-oriented question.
The best for what?
Well, I mean, is it better to eat it in food, like get your probiotics through yogurt or pickles or sauerkraut? Or, you know, does it, or should you be buying the fancy, expensive ones in the refrigerator section at Whole Foods?
I don't know any evidence that these things make people healthier, except people who are really sick with some specific problem.
Right, right.
You know, the evidence on yogurt, I mean, this is, gets us right back to the beginning. The evidence on yogurt is largely based on studies that were funded by the yogurt industry.
Right.
And I remember a yogurt industry-funded study from years ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where the person who did the analysis of a whole bunch of studies said that there really couldn't, you really couldn't tell the difference between the results of studies using yogurt or not using yogurt. But the conclusion of the study was that yogurt was very promising as a way to improve intestinal health. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, very promising.
I mean, that's exactly what happens when you have industry-funded studies, is that they're spun to favor industry, whoever the sponsor is. So that's been true. I mean, there's some studies with yogurt that show that it, if you've been taking antibiotics, that it repopulates your healthy bacteria.
Yeah.
But
I've always believed that.
I don't know. I'm not seeing anything that's enormously convincing about it. There's some studies that say it works and some studies that say it doesn't. I think it's way too early.
Wow, amazing. And yet this is a multi-million dollar business.
Oh,
the probiotics,
yeah.
The supplements.
People love to believe things like this.
I know.
And everybody's worrying about their microbiome now. I think it's really funny.
Yeah, I worry about mine all the time. You don't?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask you this question, because one of the things that has been so incredibly distressing about the Trump administration, I should say depressing and discouraging, is the fact that I'm sure you feel this way too, or maybe not, but in a lot of ways, I feel like all the work, all the progress that was made over the last, you know, 8-10 years is just being basically stopped dead in its tracks. And what I wanted to ask you was, do you think, you know, just as states are signing on to participate in the Paris Accords, climate accords, do you see a movement in state legislatures that would be more likely to promote healthy food policies in the absence of any sort of federal leadership or legislation? Do you think that states will pick up
the... Oh, sure, just look at what's happening with soda taxes.
Yeah. That's a great example.
That's the easiest example. There are now 9 cities in the United States that have soda taxes.
Yeah.
And there are states that are considering them. I just gave a talk at a meeting in Massachusetts where Massachusetts is considering a soda tax.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these will pass. Some of these won't. But there are cities that have, or states that have big cities in them where people care about public health are going to pass rules and regulations that will maintain the standards. There are plenty of schools that say, we're going to keep feeding the kids healthy food.
Right. even though they may lose federal dollars for that?
Well, they may not lose federal dollars if they work it out. I mean, if as long as they're meeting Department of Agriculture rules, there's nothing that says they can't exceed them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. There is that.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. So yeah. I think that plenty of places will. And once again, it's going to divide the population into on a class basis. There will be people who are educated and wealthier, and their kids will be fed healthier food in schools.
Yeah.
And people who are poor and, you know, not politically organized will have their kids eating junk food.
Yeah. And that's the thing that really hurts me.
And that's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really terrible. So the inequalities in our society will be made worse by this.
Yeah. Yet another manifestation of the separation between
exactly
the wealthy and the non-wealthy. Well, Marian, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. And it was every bit as fun as I knew it would be.
Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Right.
Thank you, darling. Take care, and I hope to speak to you soon.
Okay.
And thank
Bye-bye.
You so much. Bye-bye. And thank you so much to Bob's Red Mill for sponsoring Heritage Radio Network. We love you, and we thank you, and we encourage everyone to purchase Bob's Red Mill products so that we can keep that whole beautiful system rolling. And thanks to my engineer, and we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.